Howdy, y'all. Welcome to Components. I'm Ren, product marketer at Heretto and your podcast MC.
I'm Patrick, CEO here at Heretto.
And I'm Jared, lead solutions consultant.
Thanks for joining us on our weekly conversation about componentized and structured content. Hope you enjoy this 15 or so minutes of fun talking about everything from data to innovations in AI.
All right, let's get into it.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Components. We are continuing our conversation with Rahel Bailey. All right, let's get back into it.
So I actually talk about benefits of content operations at two different levels. So there's the kind of the peer-to-peer level. If you were going to describe to your peers who might be freaking out about like, well, if you do this more efficiently, I'll be out of a job. But if I were to think about this in, kind of this describing it to your peers, I would say, okay, first of all, we're going to reduce inefficiencies. Like there's half a dozen things and everything else is a subset of it. So reduce inefficiencies, because then it brings you more benefits. It extends your capacity, right? You want to automate wherever possible. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I say it's like, stop using people as slow computers. And that's really a big thing, because there's so many, if I'm going to search and replace, but I have to check because, you know, the name of the business unit is the same as the name of the product, and it's the same as the name of something else, then I can't just search and replace wholesale. I have to check each one. And that could mean opening hundreds, sometimes even thousands of documents, checking and closing. That's not a high value task, right? It's really, you know, if you can automate that, you automate it. And that's part of the single sourcing, is you automate it in a smart way. Developing repeatable systems, so that if you go away, that somebody else can pick up and work through it. So I had one gig where there were something like 13 CMSs. And so you say, well, you know, maybe they needed these specialized CMSs. Yes, except that they could never hire anybody, because if they were bringing in contractors, those contractors would have to learn each of those 13 CMSs. And some of them were homegrown and some of them were really complicated. And so it had these knock-on effects to other parts of the organization. In their case, it was like hiring and updating and update speed, because they had a legal obligation to update things within a certain amount of time. So they needed to have that like repeatable system that was based in efficiency, not in who had which pet CMS. They need to be able to scale. So you say, okay, we're doing it in this way. We have this operating model that works now, but what happens when we have quadruple the clients or 100 times the clients? You know, how can we have an operating model that allows us to scale? So you have to be very efficient with being able to add more products or more product lines or more output channels or whatever it may be. And then there's like ensuring resource availability. So one organization that I did a contract for, they would bring in like a wave of 25 writers. They had five, but they'd bring in 25 writers, have to train them up. So you had to go through, you know, cybersecurity training and this training and that training. Like you had a week of training. So this is 25 people at a week each, just onboarding. And then you would give them all the passwords and logins and so on. And then they would start working. And then 3 months later, they would all leave. And the next year, you'd start this over again. And it was just like this constant waves crashing against the shore. So you didn't have enough resources in-house. And could they have done it with these five people? Maybe not. Maybe they needed eight people. But that would be eight full-time people, as opposed to 25 people in and 25 people out, to 25 people in and out. And losing all that knowledge, because when that person left, you didn't know what they had done, where they had put it, where they had stored the source files. Like it was just, you know, chaos ensued. And then lastly, it's like you can then use this operating model to monitor your results and then create insights. Like, are you even producing the right content? Is this, you know, what's the engagement with the content that you're producing? Is it complete? Is it accurate? And so on. So that's at the kind of at the operational level. But when you look at the strategic benefits, you know, we can say, all right, this isn't the way I would explain it to management. If I'm talking to management, what I would say is, you want to activate your strategy because that assumes you have a content strategy that you're operationalizing against. So you want to activate that strategy to drive value. Mm-hmm. And if you think about how they manufacture cars or, you know, the production floor of this bakery, you're going to see that, you know, the donuts aren't in the way they are in the front showcase. You've got like a big honking machine out there that's mixing the dough and extruding the donuts and then, you know, assembly line into the fryer. It's a very different in the back end than the front end. So you want to be able to drive this value by putting those automation mechanisms into place. You want to improve collaboration across your value streams. So that assumes that you consider content a value stream as much as you consider data a value stream. And you want to enable the delivery of information. So if I'm a big fan of Salim Ismail, who wrote the book Exponential Organizations. And mm-hmm. he talks about all these things that you need to be able to be one of these high growth companies. And the final one is information enablement. And when people say, well, but how do you do that? I just go talk to your writers. Because yeah, they're the ones doing
strategists,
it.
Yeah.
So, and you know, the other is to automate these continuous delivery pipelines. So you should be able to run the way a production line does, and that doesn't mean that you're killing creativity or anything. You know that the writers might be concerned about. This is more about, hey, I'm creating an asset, piece of content, and it's not cheap to create a piece of content. You know, when you think about everything from the research to the drafting to the signing off to the reviewing, there are lots of people involved. And when you add up all that time, it's, you know, it's a good chunk of money. So why am I going to use it once? So it's like the difference between a disposable tissue and a fine linen handkerchief, right? So like if you're creating a handkerchief, you're not going to use it once and throw it out the way you would a Kleenex. So when you're thinking about your content assets, like how much use can I get out of this? Where can I reuse it? You know, can I reuse this little piece of video in a blog post? Can I reuse this as in a webinar? Can I use this in multiple podcasts? Mm-hmm. Hint, hint. Because I know that Heretto practices what it preaches. So you talk about kind of content reuse. And so, and, you know, how can I use this across product lines and so on? And managing risk. That's a big one in anyone in a regulated industry. How do I manage risk? Well, if you have a really efficient operating model for content, you're going to have less risk because it's not like you can over, hey, I have to open these 100 files and in four of them, I missed that critical piece of information. It's like, you know, I'm doing it once in my single source and now I'm going to regenerate that content 100 times as opposed to recreating it and copying and pasting and changing one thing. And then finally, it's like improving innovation, because you know that when competitors invest in innovation, then if you're standing still, that's the equivalent of stagnation. So you want to be innovating as well. And innovating with content is, as we see with Gen AI, that's like, it's a big deal. It's a big deal. So that's how I would explain it to management as opposed to peers. So I think there are like two levels that you have to think of on content operations.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a number of different ways to come at this that are going to matter more for different individuals and different organizations. But those two levels are probably the big broad strokes of where to start thinking about those things. You know, I wanted to ask you something that we've asked everybody else who's on here, because this book isn't meant to be read chapter by chapter, although people are welcome to do that if they want to. It's really meant to be picked up and used where it can be applied to an individual's given circumstance. So in your opinion, someone who's coming into this book, who should read your chapter?
I would say it's a foundational chapter. So who would read it would be practitioners, because, you know, a lot of practitioners don't think of what they're doing as part of content operations. They do it off the side of their plate, or they have done it off the side of their plate for so long, it's just part of the writing cycle for them. Mm-hmm. And so they can understand that, oh, there are better ways and this is what it's called. And now I can go and look up these terms and I can do a Google search and whatever. So practitioners, definitely. Management, definitely, because there is this lack of understanding. We have a joke. I was on a call earlier where somebody said, content operations, yeah, that's really interesting, but like, how often do you publish a blog post anyways? Like, there's this wide disconnect of even here are all the kinds of content that could exist in your organization.
Right.
And so, you know, that kind of education piece. And I think aspiring content people, you know, people in school need to read this.
Excellent. So I think that is a way of saying everybody should probably read this chapter. And I think that's fair.
Let's
I think
hope we get on the same page, right?
Yeah. So I think that's fair for this chapter. I might push back on some of the other chapters. My chapter, for instance, if I had given that answer, I would push back. But you do a really good job of pulling in some of the context and the history. And I think setting up a way for people to think about this that is valuable and they're starting to maybe select some of the more actionable or practical chapters that come after what you put in here.
So, you know, I did write half of another chapter with Carlos. And, you know, that one is for practitioners. It's not for anyone else. It's for practitioners because I said, we're not teaching people to write, but we're teaching people how to write for an efficient operating model. Yeah. So those things that you have to think about when you're writing so that you can reuse content and so on and so forth. So only practitioners are going to be interested in that. So yeah, but this one, I think it's a foundational chapter.
Very good. So I actually had this one part of your chapter that I really liked, which was this table you put in here that described before and after, I'm going to screw this word up, even though I shouldn't, operationalization. Actually, I got it right that time. Great. So you do before and after operationalization, and you define a couple of different kinds of content. So, you know, I'm not going to go through all of these with you right now, but I think it'll be really interesting for you to pull two of these out because they're kind of connected. And tell me what you think from your chapter, the difference between before and after is for product content, and then also for support content.
Okay. Can I start with the social content? Because I think all of us understand social content.
Yeah.
So let's say you're supposed to be tweeting about something. You're having an event and you're tweeting about it. Or I guess we don't tweet anymore. We LinkedIn about it. And so you have two ways of doing it, right? The before you operationalize it, it's like, oh, I just thought of something. I'm going to go log into LinkedIn. I'm going to, type this stuff into the form field. I am going to copy it. I'm going to hit submit, and now it's published there. And then I go, oh, I'm going to put it on Threads. And now you go log into Threads, and you're going to do it there. And then you're going to log into X, and you're going to go do it there. And then you're going to do it in Blue Sky. And so, and then, you know, 4 hours later, you think of something else, and you do that same thing over again. And it's probably pretty wasteful of your time. And it's very random, like, oh, did I put that one on Threads? Oh, I'll check. Oh, but my phone just rang and now I've forgotten to go and check whether I did it. Now, after operationalization, you would say, okay, I'm going to have some sort of a piece of software and I'm going to log in. I'm going to put that one piece in there and then I'm going to schedule it for all these different outputs and then I'm going to walk away. And now, at 9 o'clock, it'll be on LinkedIn. At 10 o'clock, it'll be on Threads. At 11 o'clock, it'll be on X. And then 12 o'clock, it'll be on Blue Sky. And it's just happening behind the scenes because that copying and pasting and so on, logging in and logging out, is all being done by a piece of software that can do it much better and faster and more reliably than me. And I can go on to be thinking about other things about the event. So I think that's something we can all relate to because we've all been there and we've all done that for one thing or another. So when it comes down to product content, and that's like, you know, that's where I've lived in for many years is in product content. You know, you could, the old way is like you write documents in a Word document or a Google Doc, and then you send it to, you share the link with people and they write comments, and then you have to put in the comments, and people email things around and they send you a Slack message and they stop you in the hallway and give you a sticky note, and you have to figure out where all this is. And then in a lot of places, after it's all approved, then you copy and paste it into the CMS. Mm-hmm. And then you have a specialist who goes in and they add metadata because you give them notes about like, oh, this part is for this country and that part's for that country. And you highlight it and you color code it and whatever. And then they try to interpret what you meant. And then they add a bunch of keywords and they hope they get it right. And that's the way it works. And after, if you say, let's do things more efficiently, then what you would do is you'd write your topic-based content in some sort of a central repository, and you add the metadata on it because you know why you're writing it. I know I'm writing this sentence for the UK and that sentence for the US and that sentence for Canada. And then I would, you know, hit submit, and it the system knows who to contact and who to provide a link to so that they can go in at their leisure and review it and either approve it or make some suggestions. And if they don't do it, the system will nag them until they do it. I don't have to nag them. It will send them reminders. And then it will kind of API that final content into a delivery platform, and that can be pulled by any downstream system. So if you think about how like a voice assistant, if I ask Google, you know, what's the weather, it doesn't have all of that information just you know, delivering it to me on its terms. It waits mm-hmm. until I ask, and then it tells me. Yeah. Right. So it's that same concept. And for support content, it's quite similar. Before, you would have support people who would be writing content in a database, and then it never goes anywhere. So they keep answering the same question over and over and over and over again because nobody can ever find the answer to it. And it's kind of tedious, but you know, you copy paste into an email and you send it, or into a chat block and over and over again. Or you can then with support content, if you were to say, let's operationalize this, you would say anytime somebody creates a new piece of content, that it goes and alerts whoever is responsible for updating the existing body of content. So now that answer becomes part of your corpus and people can find that. And now it's going to reduce all those number of questions, you know, kind of on a ever decreasing scale.
Excellent. Thank you. I think those examples are really, really helpful, and people will be able to, you know, relate to those a little bit more and kind of, you know, get an idea of what this means more practically. Okay, so I got one more thing to ask you before we jump off here and we wrap up our conversation. Mm-hmm. What is the one most important thing you think someone should take away from reading your chapter?
I think that the most important thing is to know that there are better ways. There are better ways. Whatever you're doing now, there's a better way to do it. And I think the other kind of, the, you know, part two to this is not only is there a better way, but there are people who can identify those better ways. So it's not everybody. You can't just take a business analyst and throw them at the problem and say, or a process engineer and say, help me fix this, because they won't know. They don't even know that some of this exists. I've had developers say to me, I've been doing this for 15 years. I've never heard of this stuff. And you know, it's a bit shocking. So of course they won't be able to help create a better operating model if they don't know that tools exist to facilitate this. Right. So that's the, you know, there are better ways. And you have to have the right people to help you find those better ways.
Yeah. I completely concur with that sentiment, as I think you probably would have guessed that I would. Well, thank you so much, Rahel. It is always a pleasure talking to you. This was a lot of fun. It was very insightful. And I think everybody, as you said, should go out and read your chapter when the book is available. It's probably already available by the time you're listening to this. But thank you again for being here. And we'll look forward to talking to you again soon.
Definitely. And it's a pleasure, always a pleasure talking with you, Patrick. We have such interesting conversations, and I'm sure we will have more interesting conversations in the future.
Of that, I am also certain.